Malaine just couldn't help herself. It was partly Charles' beautiful, sad dream that she was forgetting almost as fast as he was, leaving her with a sense of appalling loss. But it was mostly their present situation. Here they were, the four of them, shut in this ugly, dank cell that smelled of the sea. Three boys, no privacy at all, and no real excuse for a bathroom. At least the dream girl had privacy.
Don't cry, Malaine.
I can't help it.
They didn't take our things. Brutalus only took our cloaks and then called those fish faces to take us to this tower. They didn't ask for our packs. Charles still has his sword. You have the Alice Water. My brother has the spelling book.
Yes, but I'm still afraid.
He's got a point about that spelling book. Why didn't they take our magic things?
Because they don't realize that we have other magic.
So we can use another spell. It's a great book.
Yes, but I'm afraid of it.
What for? It got us out of the mountains and Rotternik and into Opal.
Yes, and now we're locked up. It's just like the dungeon the Royal Pains put us in. Only bigger and above ground.
At least no one here fed us laxaberries.
Charles was trying to make her feel good, and maybe it was working.
Take a look in the book. I don't think the orcs realize we can do magic. Maybe they don't know that magic can come from books.
She watched them, not liking it. It wasn't that it was evil, do no evil, for the books were really neutral, not evil. But they were dangerous.
Well?
But what else was there? Certainly they did not want to be left to the horrible mercies of the orcs. She hated even touching the book, with its feel like baby skin and the ugly pictures of monsters in it. But as Charles had just reminded her, it had saved them once. She took the book from Kildum, opened it, and wondered what to look for.
See if there's a spell to break out of cells.
No. Make me into a powerful swordsman, the way Daddy is supposed to be.
That's with his gauntlets. His Muvar gauntlets.
Without them, he's just a klutz. A lovable one, of course, but a klutz.
So find a spell for my sword. Or have that bird bring me gauntlets as magic as Dad's.
I can't do everything. I can't even read very well.
So get the pains to read for you. You did it before.
Yes, but I don't want that bird.
Then get something else. Get anything else. We have to get out of here.
Malaine clenched her jaw and handled the book. She flipped pages, looking for something not too bad. Ugly picture followed ugly picture. Her stomach turned. She just couldn't believe witches would do such things. Not good witches. That was, of course, the key. This book was not intended for good witches.
Use the index, Malaine.
Index? She tried looking up a spell for bird, and look what she had gotten. She flipped to the index, and both panes helped her. They were as eager to get out of the cell as she was. In the index, they read,
Break. Body. Control. Desire. Home. Imprisonment.
Malaine winced at the early listings, having a faint, ugly notion of their significance.
That's it! It has to be! Turn to that page and we'll read that spell.
To break someone's body?
To break our imprisonment, dummy!
Malaine turned the pages, distracting them before they could work up a boyish quarrel. Somehow it seemed that no matter what the subject, the page number was always 666. That's where they'd found the bird spell. Now, book again in hand, she was on that same page, but the spell number and subject were entirely different.
Symbol drawn in blood.
Well, she could make herself big and prick her finger as before, but then it would take a while for her to get small. She had to be inside the symbol's lines to work the spell. She wasn't sure how much time they would have before the orcs came to eat them.
Can we help, Malaine?
Could they? Yes, she supposed they could. If Charles were to cut one of them with his sword.
Forget it, Malaine. We owe them our lives.
But...
Make one of them big. Let him cut himself and bleed big drops of blood.
An excellent idea, if an orc didn't catch them at it. She explained what she wanted. At first, the kings were appalled at the notion of shedding royal blood. But then they started daring each other and calling each other chickling, and in a moment, they were matching fingers to see who would have the privilege of making the donation. Kildum won. Soon, he was taking a precious sip of Alice water, while Malaine worried yet again because of the diminishing supply. Now, it was over half gone. They had less big time remaining than they had used before.
Give me back the bottle! I have to stop her in again!
But she was too late. Almost instantly, the little pain was a big pain. Very big. His head almost touching the ceiling.
I'm big! I'm not afraid of orcs now. Let them come. I'll...
Your blood kill them! Hurry before you learn just how strong you'll have to be!
Charles held up his sword by its handle, and the two big fingers took it from his hand. It was hardly more than a pin to the giant, but maybe it would cut him as well as her own dagger had cut Merlaine.
Why do I have to do this? I can just break us out. I can knock down some walls and...
And the orcs will be all over you. You know they've got giant weapons and how strong they are reputed to be. Besides, if they can change frames with the opal and nullify invisibility cloaks...
Oh, all right.
Kildum stuck his pinky with the, to him, needle-sized sword. Drops of blood rained down. Big drops.
We have to get through this spell before the orcs get their cooking pot hot.
With Kildum's big help, they drew the lines around Merlaine's feet. Quickly, she dipped her fingers in the fresh blood and transferred some of it to her face. A half moon drawn on either cheek, and horn-type marks on her forehead.
Amun Buluk, Chabtan Teta.
She didn't have to look at the open book. Somehow, the words just came to her. It was as if the island itself was shaking. Merlaine wondered if it were, or if that was only part of an illusion. Merlaine looked up to see a band of daylight widening above their heads. The band ran all the way down a wall and was becoming wider. Now the floor widened at her very feet. There was a gap there, a terrible gap that went down through the floors below.
Kildum! Get us out of here!
Kildum walked the two big steps for him to the huge door. For him, it was now an ordinary door in a playhouse, and he a tall adult. He reached down, placed his hand against the wood, and shoved. There was the hallway beyond, the stair landing and the stairs. But a great tear was running through them all, sagging the carpet down into the crack. The fissure was getting worse. Kildum turned from the doorway. If he was surprised by his great strength, he had no chance to exclaim about it. The castle tower was coming apart in two halves, precisely in the middle, with fracture lines radiating to either side. Kildum looked out the small window. He could reach it now, far over Merlaine's head. He reached out a hand and pushed, and the window exploded outward. Now there was a big hole enough for him to go through, but below was that awful drop and the lapping dark waves of an angry sea.
Kildum! You can't!
To her great horror, Kildum unstoppered the now grown bottle of Alice water, held it to his lips, and tilted it up.
No!
Then, something grotesquely big, huge, and monstrous was coming down and picking her up. A drained white Charles and a pallid Kildee were beside her on something on Kildum's immense palm. Merlaine opened her eyes to see both boys flat on the bumpy, hilly surface they shared with her. Kildum, impossibly huge, stood in water that was waist deep for him. He stood uneasily, buffeted by the tiny waves. His head was between them and the clouds. The hand they were on was above the water at a height several times as great as Merlaine had been able to carry them. Fingers the size of tree trunks were bent protectively over them.
Look at that!
Above them, not nearly as far as she had imagined, was the cliff and the castle and the split and fallen sides of its tower.
No!
What had they done? What had the magic done? What had she done? The orcs would be angry with a certain justice. Brutalists would want a war. In back of them was the collapsed tower, burying with it all the hope they had of getting the opal and not creating a disaster. Orcs, big orcs, though now far below, were lining up with bows on the island. Kildum slammed a mighty fist down on the arcs. The platform of flesh lowered, the fingers unclenched, and there was the island and the ruined tower. The castle roof was now gone, and its broken windows were sad, open eye sockets. Orcs were scattered all over the island, and some were in the sea. Kildum struck down a finger. He poked it into a window, then withdrew it, cracking stone. The wall shivered and fell, stone upon stone. breath alone completed the castle's destruction. The surviving orc stood in the dust of the fallen castle facing it. Where the castle had been, there was now only a pile of rocks.
Oh, Kildum! What have you done? What have you done?
He blew the orcs down. Windy, ain't he?
Oh, Charles! Must you make jokes even now?
It's true! He did blow on them.
Do you think you could reach his mind? Get in it, as you did with that big bird?
You know I can't. The bird was receptive. Your magic had summoned it. It was waiting for traveling orders. But Kildum is just a dumb king. He's not waiting for anyone's orders.
You tried?
Yes. He doesn't block the way Auntie John did. I can get his thoughts, but I can't influence them.
Merlaine had to try herself.
Take us home! Take us home this instant!
I wonder if I'm taller than the deepest part of the ocean. I wonder where the orcs' underwater city is. I'd like to see their city while I'm here. I wonder if I can breathe water.
What's he thinking?
He thinks he wants to go wading in the ocean. He thinks he wants to see if he can breathe water.
Kill them, you dummy! Take us away from here!
There was no indication that the giant heard. Merlaine peered down. Below, it was like an incredible storm as each foot disturbed the ocean. Kildum was walking, carrying them away from the island, away from any hope of rescue when he returned to normal size. And how soon would that be? She had no experience with Alice Water, gulped on top of Alice Water. Fog rolled in, soon surrounding them like a blanket. Still, the giant splashed on, seeming happy and carefree in his explorations. Oh, the arrogance and carelessness of size. Looking down now, Merlaine could see nothing but gray. Then, suddenly, very suddenly, there was a whoosh feeling, a dropping, as if in the department store's magical razor and lowerer. The waves lapped just beneath the hand. No, he wasn't getting smaller, yet, for the size of the hand hadn't changed. He was just wading into deeper water. The hand raised just a bit. Now she could see Kildum's giant leather jerkin, and just beneath the water, his impossibly wide buckled belt. Kildum was wading now in an ocean that, for him, was waist deep. Whoosh again, and the hand elevated as the water rose. Water splashed them, wetting them, and then there was Kildum's enormous head and neck, like an island in the sky. He was looking all around the water, searching.
Kildum! Take us home!
Kildum, you idiot! Get us home before you shrink!
Kildum stared well past his hand. It was as if his enormous eyes saw something the rest of them could not yet see. Suddenly, a great triangular sail loomed, and below it, a ship with a long, sharpened bow. The bow of the boat was for ramming other vessels, but at the moment its objective was to ram at full sailing speed into the face of one normally small, but now giant, boy. The ship bearing down on them was loaded with orcs, armed orcs. It was toy-sized to kill them, but a toy that was downright dangerous. Fingers tightened over them, shutting out the light. This was no fishing vessel. It was a warship, and even a giant windbag would be hard put to send it down. Kildum slapped the water. The slap was sufficient to stop the warship, but suppose the orc sent a navy? If there were 100 ships, could he splash down the entire fleet?
He's going to get us in trouble.
I know! Can't you stop him?
How? What about you? Can't you use magic?
You know I'm not a witch!
You've got the book. Maybe something's there.
I doubt it. Besides, you know I need blood and a place to make those lines. In his hands? Here? It wouldn't be possible.
Look anyway.
She did, trembling while she turned the smooth pages. She didn't want to use the book ever again, but if there should be something here that would help, then she would do it. She raised her eyes from its pages and saw that the orcs were abandoning their ships and diving underwater. They had no fear of drowning, of course. Once under, they stayed under. They had gills, she remembered, and could breathe the water as well as they breathed air. Craning her neck upward, she could see Kildum looking down. He was studying the situation from his great height. Kildee took the book from her and turned its pages.
Here, Merlaine, here!
What?
To breathe underwater. We may have to when Kildon the dummy giant shrinks.
She looked at the recipe. Words to be said. Dance to be danced within the lines of a star. It seemed feasible. And if that was all it did, it should be safe, she hoped.
If he would straighten his hand out, and if we had the blood...
I know just the thing. Charles, now's the time to use your sword.
You want me to?
We have to get his attention. I know my brother. He won't give this a thought unless we tell him. First, we have to get up to his face, and I don't want to climb.
It's so high. Do we really have to?
Charles drew his sword. He looked at it and frowned.
Right here, just a prick on the pinky.
Suppose he squeezes us, or puts us underwater.
He won't. I know my brother, I tell you. He knows he needs us, and he doesn't want to lose us. Right here.
Skin's tough. I'm not sure I can...
Put some weight on it.
Blood welled up around the sword tip in one enormous drop. The hand they were on lifted swiftly. Kildum's big nose was pointed down. It seemed as if he had an entire flaming forest for hair.
Kildum! We have to do magic on your hand! Help us!
The hand moved away from the ear. The fingers straightened. On either side of his hands, clouds drifted by.
All right, Merlaine.
But the star!
Make it, Charles!
You want me to cut him? He won't like that, Kildee.
Maybe you could use the blood from his pinky.
But Merlaine saw that the drop of blood was far from the center of the hand where they had to make the diagram. It would be hard to carry the blood there, and it would take a long time. They needed a source of blood closer to the action.
Oh, I'll do it myself.
With that, Kildee marched up the pinky and smeared a little hand with the drop of blood there. He went to the center of the big hand and began drawing lines, but he soon ran out of fluid.
Charles?
You do it. He's your brother. If he gets mad at any of us, it might as well be you.
Kildee took the sword. He raised it high and plunged it down. In a moment, Kildee was back to marking. Now he had a copious supply of blood. It seemed a terrible wound to Merlaine, but actually she knew that the great gaping hole was for Kildum little more than a pinprick. The hole filled with blood, buckets of blood from their viewpoint. Kildee took off his shirt, soaked it in red ink, and rapidly finished the five-pointed star.
Now, Merlaine!
Merlaine got into it, and it was as before.
Kukumats mandor bigurat spia kojik alharamon yanto kankumiam sliporian chantigoristibus!
It was no natural storm. It was the action of the spell. She was falling. Air whipped through her and over her. She had the sensation of growing lighter as she fell. She swished her tail in the air, wriggling her fins, and... water came up around her. She fell through it for a distance, bubbles escaping her mouth. Her gills worked. She was breathing water. She was a fish. A fish! And what of the others? She moved her fins and her tail and her body and found herself traveling through the water, smoothly and comfortably, feeling competent. She gazed out of her fish eyes. Two other fish swam beside her. One had red fins and tail and other more coppery shades. Both were about her size.
Charles?
Me, Merlaine. That's Kildee.
What about...
He was gone when we were falling. Perhaps he shrank.
A fourth fish, identical in appearance to the one with red fins and tail, swam up from below to join them.
Kildee?
Has to be. You see, you were just in time. He did shrink.
But we're fish. We're all fish.
And we're breathing water. We're safe.
Until the enchantment wears off. If it does.
That might be a long time. That big bird never vanished, did it?
No, it didn't.
She wanted to cry, but here underwater, it was difficult. Here, she was a fish, and she hadn't been a little girl very long. A shadow loomed over them. A big one.
Uh-oh. That is one great fish.
As big as those she had seen while a giant in the lily pads. This one, whatever it was, could swallow them if it had a mind to. Big fish did eat little fish. Almost without her willing it, she was diving. The others were swimming close at her sides. As she twisted and turned, her fish body doing what came naturally, the great shadow deepened and darkened. Then she was at the bottom of the sea, among spears of long grass, chunks of rocks, long feathery weeds, and the remains of a sunken ship. Almost instinctively, she swam for the best cover. She made for the derrick and swam down under its deck. Heart pounding and senses whirling, she hid there and first saw one red-finned fish and then a coppery-scaled fish enter the hole in the planking.
Merlaine?
Here. Killed him?
I don't know.
A second red-finned fish entered the hole just as the region darkened. A seemingly endless shadow slipped by. They were hidden. Just four little fishes hiding from a big fish intent on eating them. Routine. How she wished she were elsewhere. A great claw reached out at her. A horrible body with waving eye stalks swam after it, and she knew there was a lob's crab or crabster hole here. This good place to hide was a bad place to hide. She swam immediately out of the opening, not wishing to be dinner for a crustacean any more than for a vertebrate. The others schooled with her, evidently having similar sentiments. They swam outside the ship and down amidst grass and weeds and shells, many of those shells with reaching tentacles and some with half a fish outside them. There were great, hungry shadows darting all around. She hid under a rock, and fortunately, there wasn't anything hungry hiding there first. Was this what a fish's life was like? Just one escape after another until one failed to escape? She wanted to go home. She wanted to be a little girl again. She definitely, most certainly, did not want to remain a fish for the rest of what was sure to be a short life.
Merlaine,
I'm here, Charles. Under a rock.
We're all under rocks. Or between rocks and hard places. Terrible way to live, isn't it?
I suppose you want me to do more magic?
That would be nice.
Charles, you know I can't. Not while I'm a fish.
Yes, but it will wear off.
You hope?
Yes.
Charles, it's not fun, is it? I wish we were back at the con and in our true forms.
Who doesn't?
I wish we'd never let Auntie John talk us into coming here. I wish we'd never listened to Auntie John at all.
Me too. Though it was fun taking things. Just reaching out invisibly and taking someone's sandwich or drink or piece of cake.
But it was wrong. You know it was.
Why did we do it then?
I don't know. Maybe we're bad. Maybe Auntie John is bad.
You believe that?
No, not exactly. Maybe sometimes we're bad.
Yes, and maybe Auntie John too.
Right. Only...
What?
Sometimes I think she's not our auntie.
You thought that too?
Yes. Since the time she got that dress.
You think she shouldn't have? Did you feel something just then when she got it?
I don't know. I don't know if it's the dress. It could be magic. Charles, maybe it's not really Auntie John in that dress. Maybe it's somebody who looks like her. Maybe somebody bad.
Maybe. There! I felt it again.
This time, she felt it as well. A sort of bumping sensation, as of something big moving about just above the rocks. Dare she peek out and see? The rock above her vanished. In its place was a large orc's face, its gills moving rhythmically. She sought to flee. A net was suddenly over her, keeping her from swimming anywhere, no matter how hard she flipped her tail. The top of the net closed, capturing her in a mesh bag.
Oh, Charles!
Too late, Merlaine!
Through the mesh, she could see him, dashing helplessly around in a similar bag. The orcs had caught them again. This time, she knew, they would not escape in the way they had before. The orc ruler looked into the mesh fish cage that now held all of them, all four miserable little fishes. Here, they were not about to be eaten by other fish, and here also, they were not about to escape. Bubbles came up from the great orc's wide mouth.
Little pests! Do you realize what you have done? You have brought down an ancient land home. You have buried the precious opal. You have caused a state of war to be declared between the Federation and Apple. A war the Feds surely cannot win. All of this, you immature little imbeciles, and even more. I should leave you in your fish forms forever, or feed you to something without your sentience. I will not. I am far too kind.
Yes, Your Majesty.
Brutalus moved a webbed hand above their fish cage and opened it. From his greenish fingers, sparkling specks were propelled down into the water of their cage. At the same moment, he pulled a braided grass rope, and the cage itself sprang apart. Merlaine felt something sparkling enter her gills and tickle. Beside her, sprawled as she was on a green carpeting of intertwined grass, were Charles, Kildee, and Kildum. Brutalus waited, so big above them. He was such a truly giant, ugly form.
What have you troublesome polypoles to say for yourselves?
It wasn't our fault. It was magic.
Yes, magic, obviously. But whose?
Auntie John's.
Auntie John? Your father's sister with the pointed ears?
Maybe. We're not really sure.
Not sure? What nonsense is this?
She may not be our real aunt.
No? Whose aunt is she, then?
We don't know, but Auntie John was different at the convention.
Convention? The human century convention of benign witches and warlocks?
Yes, we were there. Helba was being honored. She and my father and grandfather and aunt. They worked together to destroy two evil beings the day that my sister and I and our dragon brother were born.
Destroyed Zoanna, the former queen of Rudd, gone malignant witch. And the rightful king's evil lookalike from another frame.
That's what they told us, Your Majesty.
They told you well. Now this aunt who aided Witch Helba in defeating the former queen and her consort, she was replaced?
She was with us. But then she got a new dress.
With a wild neckline and a sexy attitude.
Ah, identity switch. Probably an enemy of hers.
She had no enemies. I mean, Auntie John hasn't any. She's just our father's nice sister.
But there are evil witches in many frames. A relative of the former queen, perhaps.
Maybe. We just don't know.
Yes, you are only children, after all.
We're kings, those two aren't. We rule not only Klinglan and Kantz, but the entire Confederation.
Yes, your Helbar was wise in arranging that. Nor are you two kings quite the children you appear. Arpal may be distant and different than your kingdoms, but we are informed.
What will you do with us?
Why, we shall send you back.
Back?
Once the Confederation has been defeated, and it certainly will be.
You declared war on the Confederation?
No. The Confederation foolishly declared war on us. The acting ruler is now King Rufert of Rudd. Helbar arranged this before leaving for the convention. He is, of course, a gentleman and an ineffective leader.
But...
His minion, Sean Riley, the grandfather of these two non-royals, whom you call St. Helens, delivered the message in the form of a declaration.
Brutalus made a motion. Other orcs came, picked them up and lifted them. The orcs were truly the size that she had been on the mountain, and later among the lily pads. And they had magic too. The Federation was surely doomed.
Take them to Orc Castle.
Orc Castle? Wasn't that on the island? Hadn't she seen its tower fall with her very own eyes? Then the orcs walked into the surf and underwater. They were going to drown them.
No! Please!
Merlaine panicked, but then realized that she could still breathe. Brutalus must have cast some sort of spell on them. The orcs were carrying them to an enormous underwater pile of rubble. The rocks were very large and overgrown with grasses and weeds and attached shells. The orcs went behind two boulders in the center of the pile, and inside there was greenish light filtering from outside. In fact, it was quite impressive. There were rooms, rooms upon rooms, furnished as an underwater castle of orcs. Grasses were growing here, fish were swimming, crustaceans crawling, and yet there was also furniture and decorations to suit the orcs. They were taken through several rooms of similar furnishings down under, deep, to where luminescent creatures of small size crawled and swam and emitted light. There were no outside windows here, and the only door led to a cell-like chamber at the bottom of the stairs. This was where they were set down. The orcs withdrew. A great slab of rock now blocked the doorway. They were locked in, really locked in an underwater dungeon from which escape would seem to be impossible.
Well, Brutalus, I hope you're satisfied.
Don't start with me, female.
The orc leader spoke to his distraught wife. If she would just get this reproductive bit out of her mind and concentrate on magic the way he wanted. But Fenibly, wonderfully good witch or not, was all orc female.
They're only tatties, after all. Shutting them up in that ugly old jail without even a chance to swim. Don't you have any feelings?
I have many feelings, but those tads have to be punished.
How? Set upon by vicious bullfishes? Taken above surface, dried into kindling, then burned?
That might do for a start.
Oh, you think so, do you? Well, consider this. Those tatties didn't act alone.
They didn't?
No. Someone filled their tiny heads with stories. Someone misused them and misled them to the point where they felt they had to steal our stone.
That's why the Confederation has to pay for the damages. It's only fair.
Fair to you, maybe, but not to them.
Female, I'm not going to feed them to a pack of bullfish. I'm not going to take them to the surface, dry them off, and have them burned, no matter what you imagine. All I'm going to do is feed and shelter the little monsters until I'm satisfied that they should be returned.
You're lucky they didn't actually get the opal.
How could they? With you and Wizard Crassnose to do magic, there's no chance.
Oh, husband Brutalus.
Brutalus sighed. Whatever his intent, he would now have to adjust his thoughts to lovemaking. Someday, he supposed, her eggs would even get fertilized. Sean Riley, familiarly known as St. Helens, also known as the father of the Roundeer's round-eared wife, Helen, who was indirectly named after him, and grandfather of the two strange kids, swore. It was something that came naturally to him. The riding in this brush was just too much. He wondered what they were getting done at the convention, and what would be their reactions when they learned that the kids were prisoners of orcs and that the Confederation was declaring war. The brush got denser and denser, and the soldiers sent ahead were clearing it at a less than magical speed.
You know, St. Helens.
Philip Blastmore rode up to him.
We're not apt to get permission to cross Rottenick.
I know. We'll go around.
By ocean?
That's where Opal is, isn't it?
Sort of. Partly, they say. But we haven't ships.
We'll build ships.
That will take time.
Yes.
St. Helens, do you know what we are getting into?
War.
I mean with the orcs. They aren't just people, you know.
I know. They are bigger, uglier, and they have gills.
Besides that, the power they have.
A little magic. I've heard about it.
More. With the opal, they can switch frames.
So?
They can disappear from in front of you and reappear in back of you. They can bring others like themselves in from other frames. There's no fighting that, St. Helens, even with any magic I've ever heard about. That one power makes them just about invulnerable to any attack and, I'm afraid, undefeatable. Just how can we fight them when they have that?
Newly commissioned Officer Blastmore, shut the hell up.
Yes, sir.
Dragon Horus crouched in the tall grass. He squeezed his copper scales flat and tried to appear to be just a part of the sun-dappled landscape. In front of him, well within attacking distance, the soldiers on their horses rode on and on, trampling brush and making a noise disturbing to game. What a nuisance. Who were they, these annoying men? He sensed that they were going to Merlane and Charles, and that they meant no harm. The leader of the men was a man Merlane had said was their grandfather. That meant Dragon Horus's grandfather, too. It probably would not be right to eat him. Dragon Horus decided that he was going to follow them. Lester Crumb faced King Rufert in the royal palace and frowned his ugliest.
Rufert, you made a mistake.
Why do you say that, Les?
Rufert was studying the chessboard.
My white king's protected by the...
I mean letting windbag St. Helens take the troops. You know he'll get in trouble.
Now, I don't know that less, and you don't either. Commander Riley, or St. Helens, as we all like to call him, has proved his leadership qualities. Without his military sense, we might never have won against Aratek's, and Helber's look-alike would be alive and directing our destinies.
Yes, and just maybe the trouble with Aratek's would never have happened in the first place.
He had to save his daughter after the witch had her kidnapped. As for his wanting that war, well, you know what things were like there.
I don't deny that we needed to fight Aratek's, but the war Zoanna and your look-alike started was something else.
Yes, but you were all a little bewitched, weren't you? Don't blame a man for what he does under the influence of magic. You and your father fought in that war as well.
You're planning something, aren't you?
Well, a little kingly strategy.
What? Are you depending on Kelvin coming back and saving the day for us?
There is the prophecy. According to it, he's supposed to unite all seven kingdoms. I never really understood that myself. There are, after all, eight kingdoms in our frame, counting Thrud, where everyone goes for mercenaries.
Suppose the prophecy's not what we think. Suppose Muvar intended it not for our frame, but for another.
Another almost like ours, but with seven kingdoms instead of eight?
Could have happened. How much do we know about Muvar anyway? All we know is that he's an alien, and that according to that robot Kelvin met, he's from a science frame rather than from a magic frame.
I never understood that either. Major and minor world frames, according to what the robot said, yet predicting seems like magic.
Precognition, according to John Knight, Kelvin's father.
Yes, precognition. But what does it mean?
The ability to see what will happen some way into the future.
Magic.
John says there's a difference.
Yes. If it's true, as we've been told, that some frames only differ in very minor, sometimes almost undetectable ways.
There could well be a frame just like ours with people nearly the same, but without one kingdom.
But how would Muvar make such a mistake?
Who knows? Muvar is said by that same robot to be an alien.
If the prophecy applies to another Kelvin in another frame...
then we're in trouble.
What would you have me do? Cancel my orders, making St. Helens commander of the troops? That would make him very angry. Besides, knowing Roundiers, especially St. Helens, I doubt he'd obey.
Well, then he's running things and not you.
Lester, it isn't good to get angry with a king.
All right, I'm not angry with you. I shouldn't have said that about St. Helens. You're the ruler of the entire Confederation until the rulers of Klingland and Kantz are back.
At least the ruler of Rudd.
Yes, I didn't mean to imply differently. It was your wine. I'm not used to wine.
Have you something on your mind?
I was thinking that someone should advise Helber, the young ruler's guardian, and the Round Ear of Prophecy, of course.
In the frame where they are having their convention?
Yes.
You would go there?
Yes.
How? You know the warning Muvar left. Only Round Ears can use the transporter.
The one above water, yes, but there's that other that possibly Muvar had nothing to do with.
The underwater one that was used by Zoanna and Roforth, my enemy look-alike.
Right. My wife and mother-in-law were to have used it with Helber. The young kings were to have used it too. My ears are no more rounded than theirs. If they can use it, so can I.
Oh, you know nothing about setting it. Remember what happened when Roforth apparently changed the setting on the transporter used by Round Ears? Kelvin, his father, and his half-brother transported to that world with the Chimera. That was almost the end of them.
It shouldn't happen if the controls aren't changed. Helber won't have changed them, and Zoanna and Roforth are 6 years gone.
You do want to try, then? To go underwater and use the transporter?
Yes.
Very well, then. I'll even ride out to the ruins of the old palace with you and row you out to that little dimple that marks the installation. After that, you're on your own.
The crystal flashed, and in its depths, the face of the security officer appeared. He looked right at Helba, but it was everyone in the room he addressed. Kelvin, Charlaine, John Knight, and John, as well as the Good Witch.
We have taken someone into custody who may be from your frame. Here he is.
Another face filled the crystal. A not unhandsome dark-haired man of Kelvin's age. The man's eyes were widened, and his mouth was opening and closing, as if with astonishment or shock that couldn't be contained.
Lester? What? Is that you, or are you a witch?
It's me, sweetie. What do you mean, am I a witch? If I were anything, I'd be a warlock, which I'm not.
If you're really Lester, you know what you said to me just before I left.
I didn't mean it, love bit. I was angry, and I was scared for you.
Your very last words to me the morning I left. What did you say?
I said that I wouldn't go anywhere with a witch, even my own witch.
And what is it that you call my witch's mark?
You want me to tell it in front of all these?
Yes.
Well, it's that purplish-blue spot on your left.
You're Lester! Oh, how did you get here? Did Zadie get to you, or...?
Zadie? What's a Zadie? I followed you, Lovekins. Had to. It's really important.
Oh, Lester, I knew you loved me, but...
That too. But there's something else. About the kids and the war St. Helens is starting with Oppel. Kelvin, you're needed back home. There may be a disaster if you don't act.
I think, Kelvin, that the answer to what Zadie did is about to come to light.
Some time later, Lester met them all in Kelvin's room and explained what was happening.
And so that's all I can tell you. Somehow they got to Oppel, obviously with the Zadie's help. They caused trouble there, and the orcs responded as orcs are bound to. The children are prisoners, and St. Helens is getting the Confederation involved with King Rufit's approval. I disapproved of St. Helens' actions because...
So do I!
So do I! Orcs are not to be casually warred against, and not just because they generally mind their own business and are no trouble to us. They are formidable opponents. In fact, about the only reason they didn't conquer the rest of the frame long ago is that they don't have the interest to do so. They prefer the sea and islands. Vast expanses of solid land dismay them. But they can handle it when they have to.
Well, we can fight them on dry land, then. We can set up barricades. They can't pass.
Not so, Kelvin. Orcs can change frames rapidly, almost instantaneously, with the help of a certain stone.
The opal.
That's it, Charlaine. The one and only, as far as any of us know.
But I...
In and out, Kelvin. Behind you with weapons, maybe with troops. Somehow, with the opal's magic, their orc leader, Brutalus, not only can cross frames and be anywhere he wants to be in an instant, he can move that way at home as well.
But there's anti-magic with the Moovar weapon. With that, I can reverse the magic of the stone and send him back.
No.
No?
No. The frames aren't magic, and that anti-magic weapon won't affect them or the opal. Your Moovar weapon counters and reverses hostile, aggressive magic that is in use, nothing more.
The copper sting? That did for Zoanna and Roforth when Witch's Fire and the weapon weren't enough.
You're right. The sting utilizes electricity, which is science, not magic. But of what worth if your enemy can appear suddenly and take it from your hands?
The gauntlets
are no stronger than an orc. An orc's strength is said to be that of 10 strong human warriors. And for once, the legend is not exaggerated. Are your gauntlets stronger than that?
With a sword,
orcs are almost impervious to sword thrusts or slashes. Their scales are very tight and strong, and they overlap to leave no weaknesses. The orcs' reactions are swift. They are not mere human beings.
The levitation belt.
Helpful, perhaps. But remember, Brutalus is no clumsy chimera waiting to be confused. You can start to fly, and then he disappears. And then you're the one confused. Then when you land, he pops out of nothing and takes your belt.
You sound as if the orcs are undefeatable.
Kelvin, I'm afraid that in that you may be more realistic than you now wish to believe.
Merlaine voiced the idea first. Since they were alone in their underwater prison, it was inevitable that one of them would.
We're breathing water now. But if we could get up to the ocean's surface, out in the air, and then do magic to let us breathe air...
They pondered that and found it good.
You find the spell.
The orcs had been so confident of their power that they hadn't bothered to investigate just how the children had performed magic before. and still hadn't deprived them of their packs. Maybe it was stupidity instead of confidence, though Brutalus hardly seemed stupid. The kinglet handed her the book, not even bothering to open it. Merlaine felt very strange. She had promised herself that the spell that had turned them into fish would be the last one she would do. She distrusted this magic, partly because it seemed to be of evil derivation, and partly because of the hint of a memory of a dream her brother had had. Charles had promised not to do evil, but he lacked the wit to know exactly what evil was, so it was her business to follow through, if she could just be sure what it was. Her fingers found it.
Escape from sea! Killed him? Kildee? Charles? We'll need blood.
So what else is new? Killed him any Alice water left, or did you drain it?
There's some in there yet. Who wants to grow big this time?
Don't you?
I did it last time. It's not my turn. I just thought of something. We're underwater, right? So blood will wash away, right? How are we going to draw anything with blood, Merlaine?
Merlaine squinted at the book. The lettering entered her eyes and mind, not at all like the lettering in other books.
It doesn't say.
I think I know.
Charles took off the shirt Helba had bought for him. Then he took his brownberry shirt out of his sack.
Killed him, Kildee? If we take off all of our shirts and tie the arms together, then soak them in blood, then weigh them with rocks.
Off came their shirts. Chests now covered only by their undergarments, they knotted their shirt arms together and arranged them on the floor. Charles drew his sword and lashed here and there, and finally, they had a couple of sections of crude rope. They put these down in the shape of the magic star.
Now all we need is the blood.
Maybe it will work without blood?
It won't. One of us will have to take the Alice water. There's enough for one more dose in the bottle. Then a nick on the pinky and enough blood to soak the shirts.
You?
Yeah.
Charles tipped the bottle and sipped the last of it. In a moment, he, Charles, became as big as an orc. But unlike the kinglet, he did not let his size go to his head. Charles held the shirt rope, now hardly more than a string to him, in his right hand. Carefully, he applied the edge of his now huge sword to his giant thumb. Blood flowed into the water. Charles wrapped and rewrapped the string around the wound. He moved it so that the whole length of it came into contact with the gore. Then he dropped the shirts and stuck his hurting thumb into his mouth. There was blood smeared on the entire length of the rope of shirts. Quickly, the pains rebuilt the star. Merlaine stood in its center.
Aquitas Bolontico Octavae Grunticius Voloniam Maxipitari Angantrasian.
Then there were prickles at their necks, and in the roots of their hair and bases of their fingernails, there was a trembling of the water and the rock walls. Then a great crack appeared in the rock ceiling. Was this to be another castle destroyer? Merlaine looked up and felt herself being sucked upward as by a giant straw. Charles and the pains were right beside her. They leapt through the great crack in the rock pile, legs kicking wildly. They were pulled up through the water at a dizzying speed. Air exploded around their faces, and they bobbed like floats on the surface of the sea. So it wasn't a castle destroyer, just a castle escaper. She was relieved. The less damage, the better, because it meant less evil done. Charles remained orc-sized. His legs and arms thrashed, making waves. Now Merlaine wished it had been one of the pains who had taken the last of the Alice water. Charles couldn't swim in his natural form, while the kinglets were swimming as if they were part orcs. Evidently, the royal pool they had at their home was not merely for show. There were no boats on the water, but ahead, far, far away, was something that could be the island. At first, she didn't think it was the island, and then the water shook from her eyes, and she definitely saw the pile of rocks that had been the castle.
Keep going! Keep going! You can make it!
Water splashed, and her position changed as Charles found his footing on shallows and stood up. There were the rocks, and there the ruined castle. For the moment, there were no orcs. Charles was wading ashore. Suddenly he stopped, his hand reaching back to his enlarged travel sack. He bent down, plunged his hand into the sack, and emerged holding the giant Alice water bottle. He bent, placing the huge bottle on the shore.
Maybe a little Alice water inside. You try it.
At that moment, one of the pains let loose Charles' hair, and dropped onto the rim of the bottle.
Kildee! Kildee!
Kildee looked up at them, made a futile grab, and slid down the neck of the bottle. A tiny drop in the bottle would now be a pailful, and a small fraction of a drop would be enough to make one of them into a giant. Then, the sides of the bottle simply flew apart. Kildee grew up mightily, past Charles in size, and towered with his head in the sky. He must have gulped down all the Alice water he could before it started taking effect. The huge dose was making him truly huge.
Grab hold!
Charles started climbing Kildee's pant leg. Kildee reached down a hand fully as big as giant Kildum's had been. Charles climbed on it, as did Merlane and Kildum. The hand lifted higher and higher into the sky. Merlane looked to either side where the clouds floated. She looked up and saw Kildee's chin, now a large cliff.
The opal! Dig it out if it's still there!
Kildee's hand tilted. Clouds vanished as her tummy tickled her. And then her brother and his passengers were put down on the shore. Two enormous Kildee fingers and a thumb lifted great rocks from the old castle and dropped them into the sea. Far faster than an army of orcs could have done it, the giant uncovered the lower floors.
Stop!
Kildee either heard or remembered. His hand came down and Charles grabbed a finger. They rose up. Merlane and Kildum supported by Charles and Charles by the finger, seemingly forgetting that they were even there. Charles swung out, making no effort to pull himself up onto the palm. The gleaming opal lay undamaged in the wreckage, down below Charles' feet. Hanging on to the weave, seeing it there, Merlane grasped her brother's unspoken intention.
Let me! Let me!
He heard, though Kildee couldn't have. Charles dropped the fearful height for her, an easy step down for him. Merlane grabbed Charles' finger. She held on tight and was lifted over and down into the jumble of broken rock and plaster and ruined furniture and art. She let go when her feet touched the top of a table. The orc's magical opal lay like an overlarge egg in a rumpled nest of velvet. She reached out and touched it. To her, it was the size of a large ball, heavy and a bit slippery as she grasped and lifted it. She was about to shout up or think up to Charles, but there his fingers were, gently taking her waist with his big thumb. The ruins receded from beneath her feet and she lay on the ground, a little dizzy, but otherwise unharmed. Charles, now normal size, was flat on the rocks above her. Kildum was there with her. She had fallen maybe twice her height as Charles shrank. She gazed up at what seemed a great tower of smoke. Kildee, still unshrunk. He had taken a bigger dose later. It would be a while yet for him.
Uh-oh, look there!
Merlane strained her eyes, wishing they were stronger. Ships. Charles touched the side of Kildee's boot, now the size of a large ship. He seemed determined to climb it, but something white and enormous moved down to a spot above them. It was Kildee's face, now the height of a windmill. His ruddy cheeks expanded. What little Merlane could see of the ships were quickly carried backward. Kildee's hand appeared by his feet. They climbed onto it, no more than the size of bugs to him. Kildee lifted them high. His great right leg lifted and he stepped into the water. He splashed through the shallows where the rest of them could have drowned and out to where it was for him waist deep. Merlane hoped that none of them fell off, because it would be unlikely that Kildee would notice or could rescue them if he did. It wasn't as if it were easy to gain his attention. Step by big step, going back, back, Merlane hoped, in the direction of Rotternik. Oh, how much she hoped